And welcome to Censored. It's Lloyd Maeve here again for part two of what became our two-parter on video nasties. So if you want to get all the background legal context on how the video nasties kind of came to be and how this category of salacious film was policed, you can do that with last week's episode. But this time we are turning our attention to some specific examples of the genre, particularly Sam Raimi's The Evil Dead. As before, my audio is grainy and sounds like it was recorded on a copied tape, but I hope that that continues to feed into the particular lo-fi vibe of the video nasty discussion. So, enjoy. One of the ironies of video nasty as this kind of really quite durable genre classification, right? It's a term that people still recognize, it still gets invoked, but it's completely nebulous in terms of what it actually names. Like, if you think about what composes that phrase, we've got medium on the one hand, right? You know, the idea of, like, book nasties seems, like, insane, right? You know, if any genre began book, you'd be like, that seems broad.
Yeah, and also, sort of, I get it. Yeah, it's a book.
Yeah, it's like tautologist. But I think it speaks to the ways in which, obviously, the medium and what it affords and what it permits in terms of, you know, seeing something in your own home, etc., you know, being and having a measure of agency over which moments you sort of dwell on, or how, you know, you can pause, you can rewind, you can whatever. And then nasty is a sort of classification of value and a sort of articulation of affect, right? It's disgust. So there aren't really particularly coherent, like, formal properties to the video nasty. There are some films in that list of 72 that are relatively well produced, kind of semi-big budgety studio features, or like art house movies from Europe. There are some that are absolute zero budget indie exploitation schlock. In terms of the things that seem to elicit the most moral panic, it's sex, specifically sort of sexual assault and the leveraging of sexual assault as a means to A, depict sex, but B, also as a kind of motivation for character. So, like, I spit on your grave. The protagonist of that is assaulted, and then it's like a revenge flick, and she proceeds to hunt down the people who raped her and to punish them in ever-escalating ways, including castration in a bath. And, you know, we kind of go on from there. And it's also violence, right? So, you know, driller killer is just like, what if drill in head? What if drill in this body part? So it's also films that are easy to kind of exert these moments from and kind of foreground them as, like, you know, ooh, isn't this the most shocking thing imaginable? You also find that with how they're marketed. So, as I mentioned, like, there's, let me see, there are some great box art summaries of these.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, so, okay, let's, can I say Cannibal Holocaust? Yeah, it actually is not what I was expecting, because it appears to depict an indigenous person, which I was not in my head. That was not what I thought the film was going to be about. And they appear to be eating a hand.
Yeah, or maybe
it's wild,
or like entrails of some kind. I've not seen Cannibal Holocaust, but apparently to its moderate credit, it allegedly at least it tries to kind of problematize the framing of indigenous people in exploitative documentary and so on. So it's notionally a critique on that, but as that cover suggests, it's certainly not being marketed in a way that would lead one to believe that, or that invites an audience to engage with that. Or we got Blood Feast, where we've just got a woman chopped in half by what looks like Einstein.
The legacy of the Pulp Fiction covers is enormous. Like,
right?
It's so obvious and so clear, the way they're drawn, the way the images are framed, even the placing of the kind of the exclamation marks and the dot, dot, dots. It's just like a reiteration of those tropes that people must, although it's the 80s, I mean, Pulp Fiction has kind of really faded away by then as a popular phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the 80s is in the mid, you know, you do have that 1950s revival that does occur in and around horror, right? So, you know, Stranger Things now is doing its nostalgia for the 1980s horror that did its nostalgia for the 1950s pulp horror. So there is this, you know, sort of, I guess, chain of kind of influence that extends back. So just to give a flavor of some of the pull quote stuff here. You'll recoil and shudder as you witness the slaughter and mutilation of nubile young girls in a weird and horrendous ancient rite. Nothing so appalling in the annals of horror. Blood feast. There's the video release of The Last House on the Left, which is Wes Craven's, I think, one of his first movies. To avoid fainting, keep repeating, "It's only a movie, it's only a movie, it's only a movie, it's only a movie." And then we're told, "Due to the specific nature of the horrific and violent scenes in this film, the front cover is not illustrated to avoid offence."
Ooh. I'd go watch that.
Well, I mean, Wes Craven, you know, it's probably actually going to be pretty good stuff. One of the more famous ones is I Spit in Your Grave, which has the kind of lightly, not distressingly, but, you know, kind of just indicated to be sort of lacerated back of a woman and her, you know, largely bared posterior, holding a bloodied carving knife. And we're told, "This woman has just cut, chopped, broken and burned four men beyond recognition, but no jury in America would ever convict her. I spit on your grave, an act of revenge." So, yeah, it's, you know, they knew what they were doing, but also, as you can imagine, when any of this gets covered in the press or circulated in Parliament or anything, you know, they've not helped themselves.
No, I mean, really, it's because it's intended to be shocking. How do you strip the shock out after you've injected so much into it? I mean, if you read that into the record in Parliament, it's like, well, like, they're pretty much promising mutilation on a screen. How do I argue against it?
Yeah. Well, I think so. This is where I think the Evil Dead, right, which is Sam Raimi's first film, you know, made on zero budget and in deliberate conversation with the horror genre, particularly in its B movie mode, is an interesting sort of example. So it's one that gets, you know, very widely decried. It's banned in Ireland, and it's often singled out as one of the kind of exemplary video nasties. But it's also one that's had, you know, a kind of lasting critical kind of impact. Mm-hmm. You know, people, not least partly because of its sequel, which kind of basically just remakes it or like speed runs it and then makes it better. But, you know, it's so the premise, flimsy as it is that, you know, a bunch of teens, although obviously they're all actually like people in their 20s, none of them look remotely sort of teen, go to this remote shack in the middle of nowhere where they find a copy of what eventually transpires to be the Necronomicon Ex Mortis, the Book of the Dead.
Okay, yeah.
Which, as our Latin and Greek speakers will know, is actually named the Book of the Dead, of the Dead, or Out of the Dead. But, you know, the dead in their own words, basically, which is, you know, as a helpful expository voice on a tape recorder informs us, is an ancient Sumerian sort of text that conjures the spirit of the dead.
Oh, okay.
Who then proceed to like possess. So basically, I mean, what happens is that the person on the tape is like, "I will now read the incantation from the Book of the Dead," and in reading it, the incantation is performed, and so the spirits are let loose, which very famously Raimi represents with, like, he couldn't afford Steadicam, so he just nailed a camera to a plank of wood and like had people run with it. But you sort of have, you know, you have the POV from the demons as they sort of soar in and leap into people and take possession of them. And what proceeds to occur is just a gleeful succession of like goutings of every kind of bodily substance. You know, people are issuing forth blood and, let's call it, milk from their mouths, though, you know, whether it's meant to signal milk is questionable. And slowly but surely, I mean, everyone is so scantily characterized, it really doesn't matter. Everyone who's not Bruce Campbell who plays Ash, who goes on to be in the next film, and is just a fabulous like, physical performer in a very heightened expressionistic mode. He has an awful fringe in this film.
And that's probably the worst crime of this film.
Well, no, he goes on to be a very handsome man, but in this, he's not cooked yet. But everyone who's not him is possessed and becomes, you know, a horrible fleshy mess and, like, mutilates themselves or is, you know, kind of dismembered eventually by him. So, like, the film kind of culminates in him having to decapitate his... It's not even clear if they're actually affianced, but, like, his partner. And probably most infamously... What set the first sort of demonic visitation involves one of the young women being dragged into the woods by the trees, tendrils entwining her arms and legs, and she is sexually assaulted by a tree. Which even Sam Raimi, with the benefit of hindsight, is like, yeah, that was too much. Like, that's... this is... I rewatched this... At, again, another person who shares proclivities, shall we say, whose birthday was just an Evil Dead marathon inflicted on a lot of people who did not know what they had signed up for, which was wonderful to behold. Can confirm these films can still really trouble and baffle people.
So you had one of those birthday parties where you showed...
Yes, right! Nasties. Yeah, instead of a conjurer, we had Sam...
It happens. They were right.
I'm sorry, Mary Whitehouse. I should never have doubted you. We corrupted and depraved. Anyway.
Well done.
Say no more. But to the credit of the person whose party this was, you know, they said they informed everyone in advance that the film contained this scene because obviously, you know, content noting, important. And when we got there, someone witnessing it sort of turned and was like, I mean, I don't know what I expected when you told me that this would happen, but it wasn't this. Like, this is somehow so much worse and yet, like, more direct than what I thought. So, yeah, you know, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be glib about the underlying sort of subject matter here. The film is extremely, like I say, expressionistic, heightened, playful, kind of... It's essentially, it becomes clear in the sequels, but like, I listened to, there's a podcast called Weird Studies that is very good on most things, but has a really good episode on The Evil Dead 2, and they talk about how one of the things that's most kind of fascinatingly horrifying about The Evil Dead is the way in which it testifies to the friskulating life that sort of just simmers beneath the surface of all inert things. So it's like the inverse of the death drive, yeah, right? Instead of all living matter sort of wishing to return to an inertness, it's the fact that all matter has a vibrant quality that like might rear up at any moment. So the deadites, as they're called in the second film, sort of say, we are that which was and will be again. And one of the things that happens in the second film is that like Bruce Campbell's, like Ash's hand gets possessed and starts like beating the crap out of him. And, which leads to the wonderful moment where he's like kneeling on the ground being like, give me back my hand! Which he eventually has to like pin down and chainsaw off.
Aww.
Yeah, it's but it's funny though. Aoife,
okay,
it's really,
I know.
Because basically what Weird Studies going to say about it is that it's just a puppet show, right? Like this is Punch and Judy, yeah, but with meat. And like in that sense it speaks to or possesses the uncanniness of the puppet, right? It's you know, they cite a book that talks about puppets as uncanny ambassadors from the world of objects. And yeah, there's this, you know, there's this sense of like what happens when we think of humans as things and fleshly matter, of which life is but a kind of epiphenomenon or a weird sort of, you know, perverse extrapolation or like unintended offshoot. But also what happens if things start coming back.
Yeah, and I suppose if you want to really embrace the idea that humans, animals, rocks, trees, you know, all made up of atoms, which are all fundamentally boiled down to the same thing, you know, the stuff of life at its basic level, you can't tell the difference between any of us. We are nothing special. And of course, that's always for humanity the hardest thing to deal with, because the ego is so convinced that we are like the most special of all animals, of all creatures. Yeah. And yet it turns out we're maybe not. And maybe the other things can do things to us in ways that we do things to them. Yeah, that is quite scary.
Yeah, but it does this with a kind of cartoonish glee. Like it has the feeling of an early Looney Tunes or something. It's like Looney Tunes if they bled. And like exorbitantly bled, and they burst, and like they just, you know, like there's a point where like one of the Deadites just like vomits far more blood than any single human body could ever contain, just like directly into the mouth of Ash. And it's so Grand Guignol that at its best, I think it completely disables your capacity to sort of be disgusted or like process it or categorize it. You know, it's again.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So this episode is wild. I hope this all comes together and makes sense. But you know, it partakes of like the Lacanian real, right? You know, that sense in psychoanalysis that beyond the limits of what the symbolic order or like language or our kind of conceptual frameworks allow us to make sense of, there is this horrifying in its magnitude, intensity to things, and
yes.
This is like, okay, what if we got there, but like gleefully and with fun and chaos and like mess, yeah. And it's, you know, so there's a point, I think it gets replicated in the second film, or maybe I'm blurring the two films together, but there's a point where every object in the room that Ash is in comes to life and starts laughing at him. And it, you know, and you just watch his like brain snap. Wow. And it's just the best shit ever. Like, I don't know what to tell you, man. It's good stuff. Like, I fully understand how anyone, particularly, you know, with either lived experience of or, you know, who has lived in fear of violence, I completely understand how none of this sounds fun and all of this would be triggering. And I don't mean to diminish that. But, I mean, I just have a borderline sort of sociopathic capacity to, like, treat depicted things as not real and thus not capable of, you know, sort of touching me in that way, which probably says worrying things about me. But like, if you can get to that space, you know, join me, dear listener, in that space. And like, it's, yeah, it's just the most exuberant carnivalesque kind of orgiastic surplusage of like jouissance that you can imagine.
Well, okay, I will admit that you're making a really, really good case, okay? So far you've mentioned Lacan, you've used some fancy French words. You are selling this hard. But I, to kind of take it back down to maybe more mundane things, I am currently watching a anime called Jujutsu Kaisen,
which okay, sick. What put you onto that?
Well, I have a teenager in the house, so they are obsessed with watching Jujutsu Kaisen. So this is our bonding moment, and it sounds in a way quite similar. Like there's a lot of, okay, of course it's cartoonish violence because it's a cartoon, but there is, beyond that, it amps it up, it stylizes it. There is more blood than is logistically possible for anybody to produce, like fountains of it, and, you know, endless punching and boss fights that lasts for 20 minutes. So I can kind of see what you mean, right?
No,
I think in terms of the entertainment factor.
No, I think that's actually obviously they're different sensibilities in some ways, but yes, I do think that like something like The Evil Dead shares with anime a sense of aesthetic hyperbole. It's like why would I do this in a measured way? Why would I be confined by mimesis when I could just like, what if every moment were the coolest moment? Like, what if every, you know, blood cannon went off as hard as, like, what if, you know, what if it, we start from 11 and then turn it up to, like, 45?
And what if every opportunity for blood became a way to depict the blood in various animation techniques or various filmic techniques that are just for the pleasure of the technique, that the blood is just a vehicle that's like, okay, so we've got this moment, we've got to make it intense. How do we make it intense? Graphically, you know?
And like I say, I understand why when it's actual flesh and blood people, admittedly, I mean, the other thing is because this was made for like, you know, $3, you can tell when it switches to stop motion, you can tell, like, you know, they're very inventive with what they wring out of the resources they have available, but it, in a way that I don't think was an intended effect, there is an unreality to some of these more extreme moments that, again, takes it into that sort of, you know, Punch and Judy show sort of space in a really kind of interesting way. But the Evil Dead is, it's a hell of a thing. Listeners may wish to start with Evil Dead 2 because it is slightly more polished and actually, I think, much more in control of what it's doing. I mean, I just find it a really interesting film because, on the one hand, it does literally everything that all the opponents of video nasties claim that they do and that is pernicious, right? So, you know, in a way that I do take issue with, the film reserves its most exuberant and exorbitant violence for the female body in a way that it doesn't in the first film do with the kind of male body. In the second film and in subsequent films, that gets more balanced and interesting. But, it, you know, it rinses a lot of energy out of that. And, you know, it is just like, okay, but like, what is the most gnarly shit we can do? Like, what is the most extreme act of violence? What is the most heinously antisocial thing we can depict? But A, it fucking slaps. And B, I think it, without even really performing it for the benefit of some kind of higher end, like it's not posturing like an art movie, that all of that stuff does do interesting things about which you can say analytical things that I don't think are just me as a kind of self-important wanker putting there. Like I think
I didn't say that. Now I have to say that was you.
No, look, I know who I am. I know my brand. But yeah, I just think that there is a kind of glee and a kind of, you know, we are getting away with this energy that is, whether it was intended to do well on video or not, does actually, I think, capture what people who are fans of video nasties resonate with in them, which is this insurgent moment of a highly democratized medium that is just like the opening of a sort of crack in the edifice of an otherwise, even still at that point, relatively conservative media sphere and sort of public sphere that lets in all of this crazy stuff that's really exciting. So the secretary of the BBFC in 1979, so just before this happens, and like doesn't, you know, when we're just on the cusp of this, says, "Audiences in Britain never see the worst the world's filmmakers have to offer. Films glorifying rape, the torture of naked women, the degradation of adolescent girls, the infliction of serious bodily harm through easily copied weapons, the casual slaughter of animals, such things are habitually cut or rejected in the British cinema. If they were permitted, I believe the public would demand that the police and the courts and Parliament take a far tougher line with cinema than they have so far." Now, I'm obviously not an exuberant celebrator of, you know, many parts of that list, but that sense of, like, do you have any idea of what's happening in, like, filmmaking elsewhere that we have kept at bay you know, British and Irish film goer. And like the video nasties are the kind of undigested, unrationalized pouring of that briefly. Like this kind of great, you know, zit had just been popped momentarily or something.
Aww. I mean, honestly, I prefer the blood.
Well, you know, I couldn't... look, it's in the spirit of the thing to be just a little gross and a little exorbitant. Yes. But yeah, so...
I mean, the video nasty sounds a bit like when the internet first produced this, well, porn outpouring, really. You know, as the potential of the medium to be that democratic, dispersed...
Mm.
Uncensored in the sense of not going through one recognized office that sets standards and that might be considered in some way part of the establishment. You know, it kind of feels like the chaos energy of the video nasty is like what happened when the internet first took off and became, of course, itself subject to moral panic.
Well, yeah, and similarly, you saw this with video games as well in the 90s and Grand Theft Auto and Manhunt and things, and then the internet. And also that thing where moral panic focuses on the wrong parts of something that can be troubling, right?
Yes. Like, always.
there's a lot of stuff that's really fucked about what the internet can do to people. Yeah. And it's more complicated than that framing of it could ever encompass. But yeah, so an interesting moral panic to look at. Not necessarily a set of films I would uniformly aesthetically recommend to your attention, but there's gold in there. There's among that trash.
I will admit that I am now curious, which before I would have been just repulsed. So... You know, I think I'm going to see if I can get the video from the library.
No, okay, but Evil Dead 2, I think if it's the one that has the best chance of hooking you. But...
Okay. Yes, you want to
I want this to endear itself to you.
I shall do my best. I mean, I wonder, is it available through the library system? Because, you know, not all the ones that we look at are. Mm. Some of them are still not licensed here, so they can't be stocked in the public library system.
Well, we shall find out.
Yes. Now, before we finish up, we got some emails from our listeners.
Yeah!
And a very perceptive email. Hi, Anne, who contacted us through Patreon. And she was interested in exploring more about the Rocky Road to Dublin, because if you remember in the episode, we actually asked listeners, specifically non-Irish ones, would they ever have a look at the film and tell us what they thought? And thank you, Anne, you did.
Yes, thank you so much, and very thoroughly.
So we're just going to concentrate on a few points that Anne made. I mean, she made loads of really good points, but... there was one at the very beginning where she wrote that she agreed with our assessment of the film as weird, but she says, to me, it often felt intentionally weird to make a point about how revolutionary obedience from Lennon's opening voiceover was unnatural and not really serving anyone. And I think that goes back to something we were worried about throughout, was like, was this kind of strange, creepy embarrassment feeling we were getting? Was this us, or was this the film?
How cringe is Ireland in this period, and how cringe did the film intend to make it?
yeah, exactly. We were rating the cringe. And I think that's a really good point, that it's kind of a political device within the film to show, you know, to contrast the idea of revolution with this definitely not revolutionary energy. Mm. Whatever it is, it's not revolutionary.
Whatever Father Cleary is providing.
Yeah, that was a really great point. And then the other one that really stuck out for me, it was a great phrase where she talks about Professor O'Brien, and she is as outraged as everyone else probably is watching it, with him sort of condescendingly wishing this new world well, even though he's done his best to make sure it doesn't exist in any meaningful context.
Preparing for a holy war, but he's like, sure, I wish it well. I won't be around to see it.
It's like, I've done my bit in the Holy War. It'll continue on. But he, you know, she says, his contribution made me wonder what all the other pensive old men were thinking about. And that kind of, actually, that line gave me a little bit of a chill when I read. Yeah, it was all of those images of men's faces. Like, there were a lot of just men's faces and the voiceover over them.
Yeah,
and,
sort of.
You know, there was...
isolated older men sort of shuffling around.
Which probably also works when you think about those kind of mugshots of the politicians and the bishops. You know, the way it kind of... like, they are obviously shot because they're formal photographs in a way that emphasizes their power and authority. But then you have these definitely not power and authority old men figures who are staring off into the middle distance. So I thought it was a really perceptive comment. Thank you.
Yeah. No, well, thank you so much for writing in. And we offer this to you listeners as a little incentive. You too can have your thoughts shared. But yeah, so please don't hesitate to get in touch either, you know. We're both on Twitter, and the podcast itself is... we have never plugged that. we're so bad at this. At Censored Pod on Twitter is where you can...
In fairness, Twitter is it feels like a dying space. So I'm also on Blue Sky if you look for me.
Yes, and I if you sent me a Blue Sky code, so I will be soon. I need to... get on that. But yes, we are findable and very open to, you know, constructive and, you know, well-meant discourse emerging out of what we've been discussing. And also, yeah, if you're on the Patreon, you can, you know, chip into the conversation there. So yeah, lots of ways to get involved in a delightful and discursive fashion.
And if you do watch Evil Dead 1 or 2 and think Lloyd might be talking out of their arse, I'd love to hear from you.
Lock them up. They're wronging. It's crook, mate. It's crook. Sure, this stuff is crook.
I already knew they were wronging anyway. That's why I invited them onto the podcast. They're perfect.
Well, indeed, yes. This is two wrongins.
Two wrongins don't make a right, but you know, we make a podcast.